Chapter 16. Random Acts of Violence. My alarm went off the next morning, chirping its evil shrill call. After I hit the snooze button half a dozen times, Mom came to roust me out of bed. I rose to a typical morning. The only hint that anything out of the ordinary had happened were the bruises and muscle aches I had earned the day before. Tyson was already at the breakfast table, inhaling a bowl of corn pops. Dad was mumbling to himself in his standard ritual of searching for his misplaced car keys. After what happened, you'd think the world would just stop on its axis, but Tuesday came with such dull normality. It was enough to make a person sick. The sun, at least, had the common courtesy to hide its face behind a blanket of clouds for most of the day. School wasn't much different. Classes rolled at their typical snail's pace, and although I saw many of the kids who had been there the day before, none of us made eye contact. I stopped by Mr. Green's office before second period. I didn't know quite what to tell him. He deserved to know the whole story, but I wasn't up to revealing it. By the look of him, he wasn't up to it either. He looked older today. Well, maybe not older, but a bit more world-weary. As if his body and spirit no longer felt like fighting gravity. I wondered if I had that look, too. You'd be happy to know that the Shadow Club finally took a silver bullet, chased with a stake through the heart. Mr. Green eyed me with a suspicious mix of emotions. Then he said, "Brett Whately had disappeared. Does that have anything to do with your silver bullet?" "Yes and no," I told him. "Brett ran off when he found out that he had killed Alex Smarts." Green showed confusion rather than shock. "But I just saw Alex a minute ago."
"Exactly."
Green stepped forward, about to ask something, but took a deep breath, reining in his own curiosity. "Thank you," he said. "You'd better go, or you'll be late for class." I turned and headed for the door, but just before I left, he said, "Be vigilant, Jared." I turned to him. "Excuse me?" "Stakes and silver bullets don't always take. Be vigilant." I left, closing the door quietly, taking with me an uneasy vertigo left by Mr. Green's advice. The next day, Brett Whately had stumbled out of the woods, two towns away, and headed straight for the nearest police department, where he tearfully confessed to having killed Alex Smarts. When they called the Smarts home to inform the parents of this awful crime, Alec answered the phone, casting serious doubts on Brett's claim. "Brett just kept sobbing and sobbing," Alec told me. "He couldn't believe I was alive. He didn't even ask how. 'You're the best, Alec,' he says. 'I love you, man.' He actually said, 'I love you, man.' Swear to God. And then he tells me he's my slave for life." "You're going to take him up on it?" I asked. "I don't know. Maybe just long enough to have him clean out our garage." Apparently, our silver bullet had pierced Brett's brain and turned him into a repentant puppy. I knew it would set the mood for the other club members as well, but I wasn't as satisfied. There was still more to do. Mr. Green had been right. Killing the Shadow Club wasn't good enough, because then it would become a legend, the way it had before. Its memory would loom larger than life, enticing others to invoke it again. No, the Shadow Club needed a different fate. That's why I went to the mall and ordered a whole bunch of denim caps to replace the ones lost at sea in the tugboat plunge. In school, I found each of the kids who had been there and shoved a hat into their hands, telling them exactly what I expected them to do, and exactly when I expected them to do it. And although none of them wanted any part of it, many of them reluctantly took the hats and agreed. That's how I found myself the leader of the Shadow Club again. The following Saturday morning, the bitterly widowed and lately deflowered Hilda McBroom awoke to a commotion on her lawn. What she found was a whole bunch of kids wreaking havoc in her recently murdered garden. She stormed outside, cordless phone in hand, no doubt ready to call 911, which she probably had on auto dial. "Who are you, kids? What are you doing here? Haven't you made enough mischief yet? What else do you want from me? Blood?" I stepped forward. "That's a lot of questions, Miss McBroom." She wagged an arthritic finger at me. "I know you. You're that Mercer boy, aren't you? The one who caused all that trouble?" She turned to Cheryl. "And you. You're that Gannett girl. You're just as bad as him." "We understand you've been having some problems with your garden," Cheryl said. I pointed to my hat, denim with the letters TSC in bright orange across the face. "We're the tree and shrub crew," I told her. "No garden goes unplanted. That's our motto." Moose San Giorgio rolled up with a wheelbarrow, overloaded with winter-clipped rose bushes. "Hi, old lady. Where do you want these?" "Leave my garden alone," she said. "I don't want any tree and shrub crew."
"Tough luck," shouted Brett Whately from across the yard, "because you've got us, whether you like it or not."
Brett's offer of perpetual servitude had apparently extended just beyond Alec. He didn't just turn over a new leaf. He flipped that sucker over and pinned it for the count. Although he had no longer dared to claim any leadership position, his "take my help and love it" attitude helped to define us now. There were more than 20 kids working away in Miss McBroom's garden. Many were members of the Shadow Club, but the original members were there too. Darren, Abby, OP, all of them. The new members showed up to redeem their guilt, and the originals showed up because I asked them. Of course, the originals had complained.
"Why do we have to do this?" Jason said. "We didn't do anything bad this time."
So, I told them they didn't have to come, but I'd like it if they did. I guess I must still carry some clout, because they all showed up. As for the rose bushes, they came from our own yards, along with other flowering shrubs that would bloom a full spectrum of colors come spring. If any of our parents were annoyed by it, once they knew where the plants were going, they kept their complaints and their questions to themselves. Mrs. McBroom paced on her porch with a combination of disbelief and horror as she watched us replant her garden, threatening every 5 minutes to call the police, until finally she gave up and came out to direct us, telling us exactly where she wanted each plant to go. Salerno stayed closed for 2 weeks. According to Old Man Salerno, he would never set foot in the place again. His days as a restaurateur had come to an end. Naturally, when the place came back to life the next Sunday afternoon, Salerno was furious. Tipped off by an anonymous phone call, he arrived at his restaurant to find about 24 kids making an absolute mess in the kitchen. Like Mrs. McBroom, he threatened to call the police on us. Like Miss McBroom, he never actually dialed. Under protest, he sat down at one of his own tables, and we served him about 15 different dishes, our parents' favorite Italian recipes, which we had practiced cooking at home.
"What's this all about?" Salerno asked, almost afraid of the food.
"We're the Salerno Committee," I told him, pointing towards the initials on my hat. "Your food stinks, so we thought we'd change your menu and convince you to open up again. After all, this town wouldn't be the same without Salerno's." He called me a lousy, rotten punk and crossed his arms as a plate after plate was set before him. Finally, the aroma of fresh garlic and basil weakened him, and he tried one dish. We must have done a good job because he moved on from the first plate to the second to the third, sampling them all. Some of them he tried 3 or 4 times. Finally, he separated them into 2 categories. He pointed to the ones on his left. "I added these to my menu, eh?" He pointed to the ones on his right. "These other ones, they make me a puke." He tasted the ones he liked once more. "Need a more salt," he said. The next Wednesday morning, 5 of the pudgier members of the Shadow Club went knocking on Garrison Underwood's door just as he was about to leave for his morning jog. According to their report, here's how it went. "We're here to go jogging with you," they told him. He laughed, thinking it was some sort of joke, but when they didn't leave, he began to wonder what's going on. "We want to get into shape," one of them said, "and since we knew you jog every day, we thought we can jog with you, because as you can see from our hats, we're tired of sitting on the couch." From what I heard, he was distrustful of the whole thing. What with vandals in town destroying his car, but he must have sensed some sincerity in the kids, because he took them with him on his morning jog. At last report, he still jogs with them every morning, and has taken to wearing his own TSC hat, because he, too, is tired of sitting on the couch. Pretty soon, word began to get out that some creepy bunch of juvenile philanthropists were making rounds in the town, striking when least expected. It was sort of good deed terrorism, dumped on unsuspecting victims whether they wanted it or not. I figured if the Shadow Club was only capable of acts of aggression, why couldn't those acts be aggressively good? No one seemed to make the connection that these were the same kids who had caused the trouble a couple of weeks before. I guess it's true that once people see you in one light, it's hard for them to see you in another. This time it worked for our advantage.
"When is it going to stop?" Cheryl asked.
"I hope it doesn't," I told her. There were still 100 things left to do. Salerno's and Broomhilda's garden were just drops in the bucket.
but that was all right. Hatred and violence, I knew, could be habit-forming, but so could acts of kindness. And just because the Shadow Club had its origins in small-town terrorism didn't mean it couldn't redefine itself. It took vision. It took vigilance, as Mr. Green had said. Never turning a blind eye. Always being aware of the danger. Vigilance not just for today, but tomorrow, and every day after that. A long-term goal. Me? I've always been a goal-oriented person. The finish line always in my sights. True, I'd always been a sprinter, but perhaps it was time to become a distance runner. If I could pace myself, I knew what I could pace all of them. All of us who wore the hat. It wasn't exactly a Boy Scout hat, if you know what I mean. There was still quite a lot of shatitude in the things we did. And that seemed to satisfy even the angriest outsiders who had gravitated towards the group. But we couldn't reach everyone. And I knew those were the ones to be careful of. That's why I mailed the package. I'd wrapped the package, and it sat on my desk for days before I actually decided to mail it. What's that? Tyson asked, stepping into my room. A letter bomb? Thermonuclear, I told him, handing it to him. Amazing how small these things are getting. He looked it over, then tossed the small package back to me. Do me a favor. Don't detonate it tonight. I'm taking Marla Nixon to the Gazillaplex. Fine. I promise not to smash your atoms before she does. And then I laughed. Marla Nixon dates Tyson McGaw. Isn't that one of the biblical signs of the end of the world? Ha ha, he said. You just can't stand that I'm not a freak anymore. You were never a freak, I told him, with deep sincerity. Just a loser. I thought he might curse me out, but instead he just smiled, and I smiled back. Have a good time, Tyson, I told him. Don't kiss her with popcorn in your mouth. That grosses girls out. He laughed. Can I write that down, my first bit of brotherly advice? Brotherly. Now, there was a thermonuclear word. So, I guess my parents talked to you about it, I said cautiously. They told me they would. Tyson looked away. They mentioned it. They said it's up to me. So what do you think? Tyson shrugged, for a brief moment, looking like the scared kid I once rescued from his own flames. I'm not sure yet. I mean, my initials would be the same, right? But calling myself Tyson Mercer would be weird. Still, I wouldn't mind it, you know, being your brother. He thought about it a moment more, then brightened. Tell you what. When I decide, you'll be the first to know. Fair enough. After he left, I returned my attention to the small package that still had no address. If it was a letter bomb, it wasn't much of one, but it wasn't a large-scale type of thing. It was more like a surgical strike. Carefully, I wrote the address in block letters. Then I took a run down to the post office, getting there just before it closed. There have been a lot of changes in my life over the past year. Awful things I've seen and done, mistakes I've made. A person can grow from mistakes, or a person can deny them completely, letting their anger build up inside them until it blows. That's why I sent my little letter bomb. And so, tomorrow or the next day, Jody Latnemeyer will receive a package. It will have no return address, no hint of who sent it, but she'll know all the same. Because she will open to find, wrapped in tissue paper, a shiny seashell. About the size of her fist. I don't know what she'll hear when she holds it up to her ear, but maybe, just maybe, she'll hear the echoes of the world around her, and finally feel the depth of the pain she helped to cause. But if in the end, all she can hear is the sea, then vigilance will have to be enough.